know, Brad, I was thinking about this. The end of year news conference, the rite of passage or the annual rite in Toronto, whether it's the end of, well, every city, whether it's the end of a regular season of the playoff, the end of year news conference with the head coach and the end of year news conference with the general manager, there's always a sense of anticipation.
Yep.
Because you think that you may get a little bit of insight into what is going on in the off season. You think that maybe now that the season is over and the secrets can be out there, then maybe somebody will say something of significance and you'll go, aha.
That explains it, yes.
That's why they sucked.
Uh-huh. And?
Or, aha, that's why that worked out. Well, Nick Nurse did his postseason availability today. Of course, the Toronto Raptors season, mercifully, has been brought to its conclusion. And I realized, going into it, that there was nothing Nick Nurse could say that would even remotely interest me.
Yes.
And that's not far from a sign of disrespect for Nick Nurse. That is a sign of the immense amount of respect I have for the way he has been the point man for everything that's gone on with this team this year.
Yeah, like, he has. Every day in and day out, you're correct.
Every botched COVID test, every mental miscue by Pascal Siakam, every bad shot, everything has been Nick Nurse on a Zoom call explaining it. So I will say that. Like most people, my interest is in hearing what Masai Ujiri has to say.
Yep.
And I don't know if Masai Ujiri will come out and say, I'm back for 5 years. I'm leaving. I don't know. He's speaking Wednesday.
Yeah.
I believe. They're giving us a day to parse Nick Nurse's message.
Is there a Bobby Webster in between?
I don't know.
I think there might be. I think there's three. I may be wrong about that, but I think
that's... No, the only person we want to hear from is Masai.
Well, you got to reverse the order, right? Yeah. Because until we know what he's doing...
Yeah, nothing else matters.
Nothing else much matters. And, you know, not that the world won't end if he leaves, but this is, as you referenced, all of these, various locker clean-out days and end-of-season pressers and all of those things over the years. I honestly can't remember one where...
Less anticlimactic.
Yeah, but also where the big boss's fate was kind of hanging in the balance, right? Like, yeah. Put it this way, not just hanging in the balance, but it's up to him, it would appear. So, like, I haven't got, there have certainly been years where you thought, okay, if the coach loses, he's probably going to get fired if they haven't fired him already, or, they might clean out the front office or something along those lines if it's really bad. But, because this thing has just been hanging in, Masai's fate has been kind of intentionally left in limbo for an entire year and watching his contract, the days tick off his contract. I can't remember one like this or one where, I guess I'm trying to remember what it was like when Gillick left.
That's the closest.
Right. Now, he left of his own volition. Mm-hmm. He just did his Pat Gillick thing. I think he said he was retiring at the time, which he's,
four teams later.
Yeah, four teams later and 40 years later. Yeah, he's still going. I think he said he was retiring. But there's one, where a guy was an architect of a team, yeah. A lot of the faith was in that organization was really about faith in Pat Gillick. He'd won two championships, but it wasn't, this one, there wasn't a countdown. Like, there wasn't that sense of, well, we're one day closer to the end of the season, and what's he going to do?
No, and it seems as if the Raptors season can be explained thusly. They thought they were going to get Giannis, so they let Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka go.
Mm-hmm.
They found out very quickly they weren't going to get Giannis because he re-signed with Milwaukee. They were playing in Tampa. COVID hit. The trade deadline came. They didn't move Kyle Lowry and the season ended. That, ladies and gentlemen, that's your 2020-2021 Toronto Raptors season. It's like there is literally, and Michael Grange's an article in Sportsnet. I'm underselling it a little bit. Obviously, OG Anunoby put together a nice run of games. Still can't stay healthy, yes. But at least he put together a nice run of games. Pascal Siakam, I don't think he necessarily, put it this way. If you had questions about Pascal Siakam coming out of the bubble last year, they have not all been answered this
year.
Not
all of them. Nope.
I don't have those questions, but that's okay. I understand.
Well, it depends what you believe he is.
That people do. Yeah, but other than that, like, it has been a remarkably... It's been a remarkably uneventful season for a season in which so much seemed to happen.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, really, well, that's the best way to put it.
You know, I think the thing is that if the COVID thing doesn't happen when it happens, you know, even though, like, for instance, you know, the name, you know, Aaron Baines, you didn't mention who was going to be the replacement for one of those two guys, right? And that didn't exactly work out. But they're a playoff team, right? They're a playoff team that's not a championship contender. That's what they were going to be, I think. I think they would have been in the lower tier of the Eastern Conference playoffs, maybe in the play-in. And at some point they would have run up against a better team and they would have lost. And maybe we would feel differently about the season or slightly differently about it. But that's, I kind of think that's where they were. And then the COVID thing completely knocked them off the rails. Then they had a decision to make at the deadline. And we'll see how the Kyle Lowry thing plays out because, you know, they chose not to make a deal for him. He can leave on his own. There's, you know, they could do a sign and trade, but he could just walk away. And then with a chance to play themselves into the play-in, for stretches during the late spring, they chose not to field their best lineup, right? Which, you know, where, you know, even though you could only, you know, like, I know they're, you know, if they fall into the top four in the lottery, we'll all go, boy, that was brilliant.
But they could have done more to, they could have increased their chances of going into the, of falling into the top four. Like, it was like, I would give them credit with it. If they do somehow get that, by some blessed convergence, get that pick, it will be the greatest job of tanking in the history of professional sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
It will be on every level. Playing away from home. Don't have to worry about ticket sales. Don't have to worry about home. Everything. It will be the genius tank job of all genius tank jobs if it happens.
Yeah, I guess. Like it's, you know, again, I think they went, I think they were intending to compete. Then COVID, and, you know, other teams had COVID too, but COVID really knocked these guys off the rails for a bunch of reasons. And then post-COVID, pre-trade deadline, I think to me that's still the most interesting moment. Like, if I could, you know, if Masai would like to talk about everything that went through his head.
They had a couple of games where you looked at them and thought, okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a couple of games where you just thought, no. And that Knicks game to me might be...
Yeah.
Might be the game where I looked at it and thought, okay,
and maybe that's
game, not happening.
And maybe that's what they thought too. I don't know. Like that, again, that's where you know, no one's ever going to be completely honest about, you know, what was going through their heads at that point. But they did, you know, they didn't do what OKC did, which is just say, Al Horford, you're not playing anymore this year, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, like, you're hurt, son. You know, they weren't as overt about it. But they kind of, you know, they kind of funny. They kind of played it both ways down the stretch, right? They would have a couple of guys play and a couple of guys not play. And
it was,
you know, and again, they still, I think the way Washington was playing, they weren't going to, you know, maybe they were, they just said, we're not going to pass these guys. It was kind of betwixt and between. You know, I just don't know how I feel about that last stretch and what they were up to.
Nick Nurse did have one rather in-depth comment about Masai Ujiri today. And again, that was the, that is the story. The second the Raptors were eliminated, Masai Ujiri's status became the story. And our friend Doug Smith said this morning that his gut tells him that Masai Ujiri is back, whether it's on, as Doug said, a 5-year contract, a 3-year contract, or something I hadn't thought of, but would probably make a great deal of sense. Almost those revolving 1-year handshake deals that you sometimes see when there is a very close personal tie between ownership, in this case Larry Tannenbaum, and the general manager, right? So Smitty may be onto something there. That may be the case. Like if there's nothing out there for Masai may be thinking, you know what, I'll just better the devil I know and the devil I don't know. At least I know what these people will let me do. Basically, they'll let me do anything.
Yeah, and I have the opportunity to pivot if needs be.
Exactly. Yeah. I have the opportunity to pivot. So this was Nick Nurse today talking about Masai Ujiri and his relationship with Masai.
Certainly well connected. He's super competitive. He thinks and talks in terms of championships. Extremely hard worker. and we get along great. Like, we're able to sit down and have very frank and honest discussions. And I think we're both kind of similar in those, the mindset of, you know, like I can tell him, this is what I see a championship roster looking like. And he can tell me, and he can tell me, you know, we really can hash it out good. So, like I said, I really, really enjoy working with him. We have really productive meetings and conversations. It's hardly, I can't really think of ever being uncomfortable, you know, which isn't that typical in any, you know, employer employee relationship. I don't think all the time, especially in sports and especially in coaching. So, there you go.
That is Nick Nurse talking today about, you could tell Nick is at the point right now where he's willing to pass the baton off to somebody else. Somebody else wants to answer these questions. Yeah. Please, please do. Let's keep this in mind, though, about Nick Nurse and Masai Ujiri. Yeah. People talk about, well, Masai Ujiri's trade for Kawhi Leonard was bold, and the Danny Green and yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. And there were a lot of bold moves Masai Ujiri made. But naming Nick Nurse your head coach was, and he may have, I'm sure the organization had good reason to name Nick Nurse the head coach, right? I mean, it wasn't something they just pulled out of their you-know-what. But the fact of the matter is, that was a pretty inspired choice by Masai.
Yeah, it was an interesting one, you know, because you had a really good coach in Dwayne Casey, who is a very, very good coach and is doing a nice job, you know, and has got a longer-term project in Detroit, but is doing a nice job. There's universally respected in the game. And had led the team to the, had coached the team into the playoffs every year. And, you know, there was nothing forcing your hand to make a coaching move. And of course, that was before Kawhi.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and I think I know they looked outside the organization. They looked at a bunch of different available candidates. But you're right. They settled on a guy who, you know, who's part of their culture, but had not been a head coach in the NBA. It's the kind of thing that absolutely could have backfired. And again, we'll never know how history plays out if they don't get Kawhi Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
But they did, and Nick Nurse did an excellent job that year. And I think I gotta say something, you know, I think he did an excellent job this year. By and large, his team's competed, you know, no matter what configuration they put out on the floor. And there were, you know, how many different starting lineups, you know, the guys that played hard. And I guess in a season like this with, you know, with a bunch of other stuff working against you, like I'm sure there's somebody who could, you know, school me on X's and O's and how mistakes he made. But, you know, what I judged on is that, you know, in a season where there's perhaps reason at a certain point to white flag and say, you know, we're going to lose this game anyway. I remember very few instances when they weren't playing hard.
Yeah.
You know, even when it was hopeless, they stayed in games. Maybe they shouldn't have stayed in sometimes. So I'll give Nick Nurse full marks for that.
Yeah, and there hasn't been enough media around the team to really understand what happened with that COVID outbreak. It did seem as if the Raptors had a difficult time managing it.
Yes.
And I don't know, and that's, I'm just saying, from a distance, I could be wrong. Maybe it was just a hugely bad COVID outbreak. But from a distance, it seemed to be more of a lingering issue for them than for other teams.
Yeah, you've made the point before, Jeff, about other stuff, but it's worth noting.
The NBA did fine them for improper mascot. Again, we can sit here and roll our eyes, but the NBA fined them for not adhering to things, and that gets to your leadership group. That ultimately falls, I think it probably falls on the coach and general manager more than anybody else. That's just me, though.
Well, and, you know, we probably, you know, a year from now, maybe we'll know. Some of what went on, because people will start being able to have human being conversations with other human beings in the same space rather than Zoom calls at some point. You know, the people who report, there's some really good people reporting on this team who couldn't really report this year.
Yeah.
You know, just you couldn't. You know, like, you could do your best, and there's some great stories written and great analysis, but in terms of the human part of reporting, you couldn't really do it. So we may not know for some time still. We will eventually, but yes, it derailed their season, and it's not an excuse. It's just the truth. Look at the schedule. Look at when it happened. Look what happened to them.
How or why it happened is a separate argument. It derailed their season. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
as I said, the other aspect of it, you know, something we need to see. However, the NBA playoffs that will go ahead without the Raptors, surprisingly enough, we are going to see the play-in games, which I don't know what I initially I kind of thought, yeah, I don't like this idea. I was kind of along with LeBron James. Then I'm looking at the matchups and I'm going, oh, this is going to be good.
Yeah, there's going to be some heat on some teams.
Oh, there's going to be. Yeah. First of all, anytime I can get LeBron versus Steph in a game that matters.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's big for basketball. That's big for the sport. That will have my eyeballs.
Yep.
Regardless of what else is going on, I'm watching every second of that game because it's LeBron and it's Steph.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think generally more is better. I know this is, you know, we're in unusual times, et cetera, and there's some of the players who are kind of beefing about the system. But, you know, as a fan, you know, give me compelling content, especially when it's not, you know, like if I'm invested in a team, I'm going to watch whatever they do. I don't care who they are.
Well, I'll say this. The players knew, they've known all year that this was going to be the case.
Yeah.
This wasn't something that was dropped on them halfway through the year. So as a result of that, I'm kind of okay with this. I'm really okay, by the way, with the Knicks having home court advantage. That to me is just spectacular. And if there's any way you can get Knicks Nets,
that'd be great. Oh. Right. You know, and the
oh my God.
Well, and the reappearance of fans, Jeff, in the last, you know, it's mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I've kind of felt it more in the last couple of weeks.
Did you watch any of the FA Cup?
Yep.
Yeah,
it was interesting, right? It didn't feel like an empty stadium.
No.
Right? And the hockey playoffs on the weekend, you know, it wasn't full, but, you know, 9,000 people in Las Vegas or whatever, but it felt like there was
tell you what, that, there. And we'll be joined later on by Brian Engblom, Tampa Bay Lightning TV analyst. That arena last night was rocking.
Yeah, the Florida, which is...
That was fun.
A place where many nights in the history of that team, they've had far fewer people than they did last night, right?
That was fun.
Yeah. That team, that series has got some juice.
Yeah, that was, and that was, that plus the FA Cup were where I really noticed. And the FA Cup, of course, having Casper Schmeichel take the cup over to where the fans were kind of cool, considering the fact they haven't been around all year. But, yeah, I'm with you. I've noticed the fans more and more. And I think now that we're getting to the playoffs in the NHL and the NBA, it's going to become even more of a factor. I'll tell you what, where it's going to be most noticeable for me is when you flip over from one of the Canadian games to one of the U.S.
You're going to miss them.
Like, can you imagine Tampa and Florida being played at that pitch and then turning over to watch Toronto and Montreal in an empty arena or Winnipeg and Edmonton in an empty arena?
Like, the games will still be the games will be great. There's, you know, I think the familiarity thing is interesting. I think, you know, look, we had, what, four games?
Mm-hmm.
And three in overtime and one settled in the last couple of minutes, right? These teams know each other really, really well. And there's a level of intensity that's there from the get-go because they've played each other so much. So those all-Canadian matchups are going to lack nothing emotionally on the ice.
But I'm
not going to pretend. It's
going to look and feel different.
It is going to look and feel different.
Mitch Lawrence is host in SiriusXM NBA Radio. We will put a bow in the NBA season, a bow in the Raptors season, and look ahead to the New York Knicks. Again, the NBA is just better when the Knicks are meaningful. It really is. Baseball's better when the Yankees are meaningful. I think the NBA is better when the Knicks are meaningful. Mitch Lawrence joins us. This is Writer's Block. Friedman joins us at 4 o'clock. Pat Tabler as well. There's no Blue Jays baseball tonight. The Jays will start a three-game series against the Boston Red Sox tomorrow with Hyunjin Ryu on the mound for the Blue Jays and Eduardo Rodriguez, for the Red Sox.
It's going to be an interesting series, actually. Like, you know, not that any series at this time of year has huge meaning. But
I plugged this on Baseball Central. Chris Black, who is a producer at Blue Jay Central. The latest these teams have met each other, with one of them being in first place and one of them being in second, since 1990.
Wow.
When they met in September of the year.
Got to think, I guess, when one was up, the other was down, right? Yeah. That's kind of the way it's been.
It was an interesting note. There will be NHL hockey tonight, the Stanley Cup playoffs. Boston and Washington, game two of that series at 7:30 on Sportsnet and CBC. Nashville and Carolina, game one of that series. St. Louis at Colorado, that should be something else. Game one of that series.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing Colorado.
And, of course, if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan, you're still watching your team play out its regular season.
I just looked at the rating. People are, there is an audience.
Yeah, well, if you're, sure. Like, it, I will say this. It is dumb to be playing regular season games when playoff games are still going on. But you know what? I thought about this, and then my friend Doug Smith made this comment. Based on everything that's kind of gone on with COVID and pro sports, it could have been worse.
Yeah. Oh God, yeah.
It could have been worse.
Yeah, like, oh yes, like in a profound way, or even in a trivial way.
So I guess I'm not.
These games could have meant something too. That might have been interesting.
Yeah,
playing out a kind of a ghost season of games while somebody's waiting to find out whether they're going to be in the playoffs or not. That would have been interesting.
I don't know.
No. In the grand scheme of things,
it's
what
odd,
the heck,
but
right?
it's really not something I'm ready to sort of go to the streets with and brandishing pitchforks right now.
I've got a list of stuff that's ahead of that.
Yeah, that's me too. But anyhow, so there you go. Boston and Washington tonight, game two of that series, 7:30 p.m. on Sportsnet and CBC. Nashville and Carolina, game one, 8 o'clock on Sportsnet East. St. Louis and the Colorado Avalanche, game one of that series at 10 p.m. on Sportsnet and Sportsnet One. Let's bring in Mitch Lawrence of XM NBA Radio. Mitch, thanks for joining us. You know, I was making this point just before the break where I agreed with LeBron about the whole play-in thing. We're talking about how the NHL is finishing out its regular season in some cities where COVID hit at the same time that the playoffs are starting. And I said, it's kind of dumb, it's kind of silly, but you know what, given that everything that's gone on here, I'm not willing to go to the streets and riot and burn and, you know, tear things down as a result of it. But I got to say this, the play-in, you give me LeBron and Steph in a game that means something, I'm okay with this.
Okay, you should be better than okay, and I'm glad you're not out there pillaging like you usually do.
But I'm not, this is like...
Right? I mean, no, here's the thing. There will never be... I'm going to go out on a limb and tell you, there will never be a better playing game than this one. Why? Yeah. Because you have the best player in the sport, who's arguably the best of all time, with all due respect to Michael Jordan, but there is that debate. Mm-hmm. I'm on the Jordan side on this. And then you have the greatest shooter in the history of the game. Name me a play-in game in the next 100 years which will have both of those components.
Yeah, it's not happening.
You can't because basically, by definition, those guys are already in the playoffs. We've just had a fluky year where Golden State's missing Klay Thompson. Golden State's missing, Kevin Durant, but forget that. Golden State's missing, pieces. LeBron gets hurt, which, you know, that's a very huge deal. This play now. You know, we're shooting 1-for-4 here on play-ins because the other three games stink, basically. I'm supposed to get excited about Charlotte, losers of 16 of the last 21 games, going into Indiana, losers of, 10 of their last 18? Two sub-500 teams? Look, I know it's a special year. It's the COVID bounce. You know, it's kind of a bounce back here from the bubble. COVID is still a big deal. Going forward, the league is going to continue with these teams that are sub-500, and there are quite a few of them. There's only Memphis, Golden State, and the Lakers who have winning records. The other teams are 4 or 5 games under 500. To me, that's not a good look. To me, that's not what the NBA should be rewarding teams. This whole thing about, let's honor mediocrity or worse, I don't get it. It's to me, you know, and here's the thing, too. Fan bases, I hear all this stuff about, it's great for the fans because they have something to cheer about. You want to tell me a Boston Celtics diehard fan who's over the age of 30 is excited about this year and the play-in? Like, are you kidding me? You know what they're excited about? Figuring out what Dan, you know, they're excited about hearing from Danny Ainge about what the hell he's going to do with this team, this roster, and this coach, and getting better for next year. And I'll tell you what, the players' mentality of accepting it, except for LeBron and a few others, I've talked to players who played in the 80s. And 90s about this, they're like, we would be like, you know, we ain't good enough. We got a losing record. We don't deserve this stuff. So it's, I know it's a different time and place and everything, let's chew on those things for a while.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And look, I know what you mean about the sub 500 teams, especially. But you know, in other sports that have added like added wild cards, right? Added expanded playoffs. The National Football League did it. Major League Baseball did it. And you know, we have had wild card teams go all the way. You know, and again, I'm not sure how we're supposed to feel about that, but sometimes it's a fun story. You know, if one of those teams, and again, I can't imagine it, that, you know, like I could see a team like Washington giving somebody trouble, but, you know, they would have been in the playoffs in the original format, right?
Eighth seed or whatever. I mean,
yeah, but
and by the way, how many years is it now where we keep hearing, oh, things are cyclical? The Eastern Conference, they'll never, you know, it's not going to be long before it'll change and the seventh and eighth won't be sub 500. Man, that's been going on for decades. I don't want to hear that. But I just don't like – it's like I've got a thing. I don't like guys from sub-500 teams who are all-stars, mm-hmm. let alone teams extending their seasons when there should be a certain degree of shame, a certain degree of, you know, we ain't good enough. Let's get out of here. Let's regroup. Let's go find a way to get better, whether it means changing your GM, firing your coach – getting more luck in the lottery. I mean, look at New Orleans. Look at the Pelicans. The playing game was designed for them, and they're 0-2. Because Zion Williamson, I hate to say this, what's he do for winning? I like Zion Williamson, likes the way he plays at one end offensively. Does he really impact winning like the great young players of yesteryear? The answer is no. Otherwise, they'd make a play-in game. We're not talking about playoffs, we're talking about play-in.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even get them there. What does that tell you? Maybe he ain't so special.
I was going to ask you if the Knicks are on the verge of winning back the city of New York, but I will rephrase
that.
Yeah, I will.
They never lost it.
That's what
they never lost.
That's what I was going to say. The
never lost it.
The what's the mood like around there right there right now amongst Knicks?
Well,
Knicks
fans? I have to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a long 15 miles from NYC. I do everything remotely now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't have to go in and do my show.
Right.
But just from talking to people and the news and the sports shows, it's Nick Wild again. Remember, the Knicks are the traditional team. The Knicks are, you know, they predate the Nets by decades. The fans, especially older fans and even younger fans who go back to the 90s, some who go back to the 70s and the late 60s, man, they're going nuts.
Yeah.
Why? Because after 20 years of just bad management, bad basketball, bad decisions, you name it, they got something now. They know that they're not going to win the title. But at least they got a team which they can embrace because they work hard. They don't give up. They fight on defense. They're coached by a guy who's no nonsense, doesn't believe in cutting corners. They don't care about the Nets. Knicks fans, were they depressed when Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving wouldn't give them a meeting? And then when they were free agents, they wouldn't even take their calls. And then they went to the Nets. Yeah, that was depressing. But now they feel like they're building something that's got some real foundation to it with Tom Thibodeau. Now we'll see how these guys play in the playoffs. We'll see. You know, now in New York, the mentality probably is, well, they should sweep the Hawks. They beat them 3-0 in the regular season. You know, Tibbs will come up with a way to take the ball out of Trae Young's hands and, you know, cut off the head of the snake and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the Knicks fans don't care about the Nets. Believe me. They don't care about the Nets.
Mitchell.
And the city is now – and the Knicks have always had – one more point. The Knicks have always had legions of fans compared to the Nets.
Well, who are the Nets fans? Because I'm – you know, like it's
– Who are Nets fans?
Yeah.
I'll tell you who are Nets fans. People from Jersey who watched them here for years, some still have their allegiance. Some go to Brooklyn. A lot don't. There are people who grew up whose parents were Net fans when they played on Long Island in the ABA days, mm-hmm. right? And they played at the Nassau Coliseum. But, you know, you just – believe me, when you go around here in well, – I'm living not that far from where the Nets used to play. And now I'm out on the streets. I see more people in Knick garb than ever before. You know, they brought it back out because they're no longer embarrassed to wear it. And you have, you know, here's the thing. The Nets moved to Brooklyn because it was a real estate deal, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the Barclays Center, and Brooklyn's the hip place. You go around a lot of parts of Brooklyn, that's still Knick country. That is always going to be Knick country. I'll tell you what, when they moved and this was an unpopular opinion, but I voiced it at one point. I said, why are the Nets moving closer to the Knicks? It makes no sense. I thought they should have left the area, period. Now, they decided to stay. They decided to take on the big blue and orange machine, you know? And while the Knicks were down, you know, the Nets could get these guys. And, hey, they could win the title this year, and they'll have a parade in Brooklyn, but a lot of New York won't even be paying attention.
Is to your mind, Mitch, is Tom Thibodeau's Tom Thibodeau's a guy in the past that has worn out his welcome. Do you think that New York might change that because it is New York, you know, and that maybe somehow this will allow Tom to stick around for a while longer and see this project through to the end?
Well, he wore out his welcome with front offices, right, in Chicago and Minnesota for various reasons. And then, with the owners. It remains to be seen here in New York. I think right now in New York, James Dolan, the owner, who made a plethora of just awful moves before he hired Leon Rose, who hired Tom Thibodeau, and you got to give Dolan at least credit for that. There's always the Dolan presence. Is he going to get impatient? Is he going to want to, try to all of a sudden, now we're going to do this move, that move, the other move, against Tom's wishes in terms of building, how they want to build, I don't know. I mean, Dolan's got to stay out of it. He's got to stay in the background. He can't meddle, which is, sometimes he has meddled in the past. Right now, he has to be ecstatic. Knicks fans have to be ecstatic. I mean, there was some, when they got Derrick Rose, it turned out to be a great move because Derrick Rose has been like a different player here. I'm not saying he's the MVP Derrick Rose, but he's a lot better than what we saw in the first go around in New York. When they got him, people were going nuts about what is Tom trying to do? He's trying to win games. Yeah, they haven't won games since 2013. And like, oh my God, he's going to take minutes from Emmanuel Quickley. As if Emmanuel Quickley is amounted to, people thought he's going to be the rookie of the year. He came back to earth. I mean, he got Derrick Rose because Tom wants to win. That's the bottom line. And Dolan's bought into what Tom wants to do. Tom wants to add veteran guys who are going to help him win. Tom's impatient when it comes to that. He's not into developing 15-guy young players. He wants to win. He wants to show some dividends. So I think right now, the honeymoon continues. It's even going to get better now if they lose to Atlanta, or Knicks fans are going to be upset. Yeah, because they think they swept them. And they think they should beat them again in the playoffs. But, we'll see what the future holds. Look, let's all remember, you really think Julius Randle's leading this team to the promised land? Do you think he's Patrick Ewing? Mm. He's not. He's the most improved player in the league. He'll probably get some MVP votes. But I don't think that he's the type of guy who you're going to say all of a sudden, oh, yeah, he's the guy we can definitely build around a championship contender. That's going to be the big problem for Tom and for Leon. And for Dolan is like, how do you get Kevin Durant? How do you get the next, how do you get these guys?
Yeah.
Because that's what you need. Look, how do you get Kawhi Leonard? You guys know that better than anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Dolan's distracted by his hockey team right now, which is a good thing if you're a Knicks fan, right? Like, he's just realized he owns a hockey team. He's messing with it.
I read an account where, there were a lot of factors that went into it, but Dolan saw the grit and determination of the Knicks team and said, my team on the hockey rink needs a little more of that kind of heart. So who knows? The one thing about Dolan is he doesn't talk to the media. I used to sit there and talk to Jimmy, and I'll tell you what, he grew up a big-time hockey fan. He was out on Long Island, and, when you pressed him about Knicks stuff, he didn't want to talk because he felt like you were like being disrespectful or whatever, instead of just, doing your job as a reporter, trying to pick his brains. But boy, when it came to the Rangers and hockey, he loved to talk about that stuff.
Mitch, from a distance, what did you make of this Raptor season?
Well, look, I know Nick Nurse the other day said it had nothing to do with us relocating to Tampa. Nobody's buying that. A lot of it starts with that. Playing 72 road games, to me, it's a throwaway year. Still counts. Still counts for the players. It still counts for all these guys. I don't know who's going to be held accountable for it, if anybody. But, I'm not surprised. You can't all of a sudden say, you know what, we're going to pick up from where we are and we're going to go, how many miles away down to Florida. They should have been here in Newark playing at the where the Devils play, Prudential mm-hmm. Center. And that would have been, I think, a little smarter. But anyway, decided on Tampa. Okay, fine. And he just felt like, this is going to be a wasted year. Why? Because you just can't uproot like a team and like, we're going to plunk it down here and play. I don't know if that works. It didn't work, right? We saw it didn't work. And so I still think whether they really wanted to keep Marc Gasol or Ibaka, I think those guys are like, man, we got a championship with Toronto. Now they're trying to move me and my family to Tampa. I think I'll go west to Los Angeles, maybe try to win a ring with the Clippers or the Raptors. Yeah, the other thing I look at is like, why are you holding on to Kyle Lowry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know he's Mr. Canada. I know he's Mr. Raptor. It really should be Kawhi. But all right, it's Kyle Lowry off of, you know, all the years he's put in. Don't you want to get something for him? I mean, here in New York, they traded Patrick Ewing once.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, Patrick Ewing was about as big as they get. No, he didn't deliver a title. He got close a couple times. But, man, I mean, yeah, the Knicks finally said, somebody finally got the idea. You know, as good as Patrick's been for us, it's great. He's kept us relevant. He's kept us going to the playoffs every year. We got to move on. That's what the Raptors have to decide to do. So, you know, the other thing, it's not just this whole relocation. It's the exodus of prime talent, starting with Kawhi, Danny Green, Ibaka, Gasol, Norman Powell. What's coming in? Can't just have an outflow of your best players. Something's got to be coming back. And then, Siakam, you know, you're paying him like he's a big-time number one guy, but he looks like he's just an immature player who needs a lot of work above his shoulders.
Mm.
Above his neck, I should say.
Mitch, really good of you to do this as always. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it, guys. Enjoy those playing games.
No, the one.
The one. 10 o'clock Eastern time, and I'll be watching.
Yes.
We all will. Take care, Mitch.
Thanks, Mitch.
All right, see you. Thanks, guys.
All righty. Mitch Lawrence of SiriusXM NBA Radio. Brian Engblom is a Tampa Bay Lightning TV analyst. He played in that 1979 series between the Montreal Canadiens and the Toronto Maple Leafs, which, of course, will be a talking point, given the fact that on Thursday, the Canadiens and Leafs start their playoff series. Talk to Brian about that. Take a look back at last night's 5-4 win for the Tampa Bay Lightning, the first game of their series against the Florida Panthers. This is Writer's Block. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Right, welcome back to Writer's Block. Elliot Friedman and Pat Tabler will join us. The Blue Jays, Mr. Brent, pretty good weekend there. They added a couple more to the injured list, but taking two of three from the Phillies and finishing the first part of their interleague schedule 9-2 is huge because they've taken advantage of the fact that the Braves and the Phillies aren't entirely whole right now, or they're certainly not hitting on all cylinders. Boy, they've got a lot of games against the Orioles left. They've got a lot of games against some bad teams.
They got the Tigers they haven't
got
seen.
The
they
Tigers.
Got 19 against the Orioles. They don't see them until late in mid-June or something, right?
I've been saying this now for a couple of weeks, but I think this run of success against interleague teams, I just think the AL East is going to be a lot tougher than we thought it was. Because of the Red Sox.
Well, putting wins in your back pocket when you're not at full capacity, too, it matters, right?
Like that's the other thing.
Like, you could have dug yourself a hole by now. And look at the Twins, right? Good team. And, the 10 games under 500.
Yep.
Now, that's a big hole. And they might get out of it. But, historically, not many teams have.
No.
The Washington did it a couple of years ago. But, I think to have your heads, more than above water right now, I think the starting pitching settled down. Again, there are going to be additions, but there's some consistency in the rotation. The next man up stuff in the bullpen is kind of ridiculous at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Jeremy Beasley thought he would be facing Bryce Harper to close out a ball game a week ago.
I don't think Charlie Montoya did either. Something tells me.
So, it was tough watching Tim Mays on the weekend. I will say that.
The Boston Bruins and Washington Capitals will continue their series tonight at 7:30 on Sportsnet. Game 2 of that series. Nashville and Carolina, St. Louis and Colorado, they will start their series tonight as well. The playoffs got going yesterday, and what a lot of fun that Tampa Bay Florida Panthers game was, I should say. Brian Engblom is the Tampa Bay Lightning TV analyst And it was also part of the 1979 Montreal Canadiens. And, of course, the Canadiens and Leafs are going to meet in the first round of the playoffs beginning on Thursday. Brian, thanks so much for joining Stephen and myself. Before we talk about 79, you know, we were making the point that we're kind of getting used again to watching games with fans in the stands. And I'm a soccer fan, so I mentioned to Mr. Brent that the FA Cup on the weekend, there were fans in the stands. It was really cool. That game last night, I thought, was it's not – okay, we're not full capacity yet, but that was about as close as I felt in a long time that I was watching a game where people had paid money and had a vested interest in seeing what was going on in person. I don't know how you felt about it.
Yeah, I did too. What was it, 9,600, I think they had mm-hmm. there? They made a lot of noise. The players that we interviewed during the game and after the game, Quenneville mentioned it, Cooper mentioned it. It was terrific. They were in full voice, and you could tell they appreciated being able to be there too. The players love it. Look, I mean, they're in the entertainment business, right? They thrive off the give and take with the fans. Even when you're on the road and they're booing the hell out of you, it's good. It's great. It drives you on. I thought it was great, and all of us enjoyed it after way, way too long without fans or not very many fans.
Yeah, boy, it did feel good. Brian, all these close games, you know, three overtime games, but a lot of razor thin margins. These are teams that have played, you know, they know each other backwards because of the way the schedule worked this year. Do you think that's part of what's going on here? That's, you know, that there's an enormous amount of familiarity, more familiarity than there normally would be heading into the playoffs. The emotion level's really good too, but you know, first round is always awesome that way. But I don't think we've had three overtime games in a row in a first round before. So it's, you know, something kind of special is happening there.
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are. You end up with a fair number of overtime games in the playoffs every year, and a lot of the margin for error is very slim in most years. But I agree with you absolutely that playing each other 8 or 9 or 10 times, depending on which division you're in, breeds a lot of familiarity, which means that more than likely somewhere along the way you've run into the wrong guy way too many times and you don't like it much. So the animosity and the anger, and there was like hatred almost in the game last night with Florida and Tampa. But did they go at it? I mean, there was no ebb and flow to the physical part of it. It was every shift. I mean, you could smell it in the air. I think that's why the fans got so jacked up too. And yeah, because you do play them so much. And yes, the closeness is because, like, you can study film all you want going into a series, and maybe, you know, it's been East versus West in a regular season. You've played the team twice. You don't have a feel. And for me, I've always been, you know, as a player, I think about it as a former player, and I go, I want to know what it's like to play against this guy. I want to know what it's like to play against Barkov, against Kucherov, against Cirelli, against Bennett or Huberto. And know their moves, and to watch them and say, you know, watch out for this move, or watch out, he does this. But when you've been through it and he's beaten you a few times, or you've beaten him or whatever, that it's different. So yes, there is that familiarity. And I think that, along with the intensity that comes with playoffs, that the players buckle down and realize that every shift, every goal matters. And you don't want to be the one that's out there making a big mistake and have a, you know, going down 1-0, or, you know, cause the game-winning goal to go in. So I think all of that figures into the schedule the way it's been this year.
You know, Brian, we just have 2 minutes left here, but I did want to ask you about that 79 series, because it seems to me it's interesting. That was the last time these teams have met in the playoffs. Of course, the follow-up to that was that series against Boston. It almost seems to me that was the point that Boston and Montreal became more of a thing than Toronto and Montreal. Is that, from a player's point of view, did you get that sense?
Yeah, for sure. It was because, you know, the English, French, the Toronto, Montreal, yeah, it's made the measure. Two Canadian teams, all of that. But when I was there and at that time, yeah, because we only played them in that 79 series, and we played Boston so many other times. It was different. Played Boston in the mm-hmm. finals the 1 year, played them in the conference finals the other, the famous too many men on the ice. So, yeah, I think there was a bigger rivalry in my mind, certainly between us and Boston than us and Toronto, for sure.
Brian, we really appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, guys. Enjoy.
Take care. That's Brian Engblom, Toronto Maple Leaf, or Tampa Bay Lightning TV analyst, former NHL defenseman.
Yeah, they got a fun series on their hands down there, I'll tell you. That Florida series is really
good. Yeah, cool. I think...
They're all good. There's a lot of good hockey.
No, it's... I still don't know the Minnesota Wild. I was watching. I watched part of that game, and you could tell the frustration. I mean, you want to talk about palpable frustration mm-hmm. on the part of hockey players. Of course, you know, if you're the Minnesota Wild too, you just it's not like there's a proud tradition there of playoff hockey. But my goodness, I wonder what that win has done for them.
Yep.
That would have been, if you were the Wild, that would have been an awful game to lose in overtime.
It would have been brutal.
Like, that would have just been, we did everything we possibly could to beat that team.
Yep.
And it's just not happening.
But that game, boy, a classic example that it's not all about the goals, right? That game was tense all the way through. There were lots of chances. There was lots of physical, it was a really physical game. That was, you know, I say that it feels to me like this playoff has just started, like, snap. Like, intensity, let's go, full bore. And I do think it's about the fact that, you know, there's the familiarity, right? That you know exactly. You know, Washington and and Boston play
1,000 times this year.
Yeah, it feels like it, right? Like they're playing every other weekend, right?
And I gotta say this as well, that I think that what has happened here is it's not just a matter of the familiarity, but I really do think that there's a sense that you can't approach the games the same way you approach the regular season games. And what I find, and we know the first round of the playoffs is generally really good anyhow.
It's the best.
So I think all of that is kind of coming together here. And I'll tell you what, I'd be willing to bet a lot of players and a lot of coaches and a lot of teams have said, look, we know everything they're going to do. They know everything we're going to do. We got to go out there and kick their ass. We just basically have to be tougher right now.
Yeah, like, not going to outsmart them.
We can't outsmart them. We need to do all that extra emotional stuff to get over.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe that's the case. Elliot Friedman of 31 Thoughts on Hockey Night in Canada is next. This is Writer's Block.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
So we still have three sleeps. Is that right? Three mm-hmm. sleeps until the Leafs and Canadians start their playoff series. But that doesn't mean that we won't have playoff hockey to talk about or watch, or that we don't have playoff hockey to talk about or watch. I would suggest to you, well, we'll bring in Elliot Friedman of 31 Thoughts and Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL and Sportsnet. Mr. Friedman, as always, thank you for doing this. I would just about to suggest to Mr. Brunt that if the rest of the playoffs match up to what we saw initially, what we've seen initially, what we saw last night, certainly, that old adage about how the first round is quite often the best round of the playoffs may not only hold true, it may be magnified here, because as the point Brunt made, and I think it's really well made, is, you know, these teams know each other so well right now in the first round of the playoffs that you almost get the sense that there's even more of an emphasis placed on stuff like emotion and intensity, right? Because there are no secrets.
I'm sensing a really good advertising strategy. The Stanley Cup playoffs. Watch now before it gets worse.
Well. No, but Elliot, the first round.
There we go. Yeah.
It's the same thing it's the same thing in baseball. The best playoff games in baseball are in the first round.
Yeah, we were really lucky. I think, you know, the one of the things that kind of happened this year is that a lot of the playoffs got decided early in terms of at least who was going to make it, if not the matchups. So the kind of the final week lacked a bit of the drama. And, you know, I thought that one thing I was really hoping for was that because that was happening, maybe some guys could get healthy and maybe it would allow them to ramp it up once the playoffs started. And so far we got that. I mean, it always happens, you know. And one of the things that I really believe, guys, is people say like the officiating changes in the first round and things like that. I don't believe that. I think the thing that changes the most is the players. You know, you take games off during the regular season. You're not as focused on some of your opponents. That goes all out the window now. Like, nobody takes nights off now. You're playing the same team. Travel is no longer an excuse. I think these guys get riled up for this round, and we saw a perfect example of it on the weekend.
Yeah. Of course, some guys are really well rested, like Kucherov. He's very well rested. you got to. I have no outrage there. I think that's the system, right? Like, that's.
Yep.
You got to just kind of tip your cap to people being clever. Maybe they'll close that loophole someday, but I can't fault them for taking advantage of it.
I'm with you. You know, like, for example, it's not like this is the first time it's ever happened. If you want to stop it, you can stop it.
Yeah.
Now. So one, it says to me that the league is not really too interested in stopping it. And number two, I think that the other thing is, like, how are you going to do it? Like, I was talking about this with someone the other day. If you're really serious about stopping it, how are you going to do that? And, like, I mean, you could say, all right, Kucherov, I think he practiced for 12 days. You could say, okay, you can't have more than 5 days of practice. Maybe. But, you know, someone made a good point to me there. What if the guy's coming back from something like a concussion? Mm-hmm. Can you really do that? And so I think there's always arguments and counter arguments, but at the end of the day, you know, Vancouver used to do this. Mm-hmm. Chicago won a Stanley Cup because they did it. You know, it's not like this is a new phenomenon or a new problem. I know why it makes people crazy, but I'm almost at the point where if I was an owner, and I know what it comes down to money, but if I was an owner, I would be saying, maybe we should be doing it too.
Yeah. No, I think that's, you know, fight fire with fire. Like, that's yeah. It's the only way you can approach it, right? Is say, look, how come we weren't smart enough to do this? Or is there something we can exploit here? Right. I think that's smart teams in all sports, you know, whether it's in cap agreements or just in larger collective agreements, you know, the smart teams are always looking for something. Like, that's just.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So hire smart people, I would say. But, you know, when you watch Kucherov come out like he was shot out of a rocket, I also understand people saying, hang on, that doesn't seem entirely fair. That's going to be a great series, though, isn't it, Elliot? Like, that's got some juice.
It sure does. And, you know, I don't know if they can do six more games of that. Like, that was pretty high-intensity stuff. I think the other thing, too, Steven, is that, you know, the thing that was amazing to me about that game last night was it never slowed down. Merrick, we were talking today, and Merrick said, you know, sometimes you see a game like that and it's like that for the first 10 minutes and then everybody kind of settles in. That never happened last night. Like, it was never it never got to a point where, you know, guys looked tired or guys looked like they spent all of their emotional energy. Like, that never occurred. It was wire to wire, outstanding energy and pace. And I mean, I don't know if you humanly could do six more games like that, but I sure wouldn't mind seeing them try.
Elliot, how much of that do you think came from the fact that there were 9,600 fans there? And yeah, we can make jokes about Florida, 9,600 fans, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. But that looked and felt a little more like a hockey game as opposed to the stuff we're seeing up here with no fans. Do you think that had an impact on it? Like, just the idea that you're playing, you know, it feels meaningful when there are people there watching you.
It had to, you know, like, how could it not? Honestly, I mean, I felt the energy in my office watching the game. I don't know how anybody could think that didn't play a role. It was, the crowd was going bananas, and you know, I think players feed off crowds like that. It's really interesting. I hear that the NHL is, you know, kind of confident that they think they have a shot at getting the Canadian teams to be able to play at home in the third round. I mean, we won't know probably until after round number one, but it sounds like they feel they have a shot at getting it to happen. I don't know. I mean, like, I understand it. Like, I think, you know, families would probably prefer their their husbands or partners who play on these teams are able to come home at night and things like that. But I got to tell you, just from like, and I realize it's a selfish point of view and everything like that, but if you were to put a Canadian team, like say Toronto wins,
yeah,
and you put them in Buffalo, you know, what are the possibilities of a crowd there of Leaf fans?
Oh, really good.
Well, yeah. If you can get across the border, right? I guess that's, you know, this is where it gets.
You can always go one way across the border.
I guess.
I mean, like, I realize this is imperfect and some people aren't going to like I'm suggesting this. I'm talking about it from a purely entertainment point of view.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is a league that's it's probably going to come in around somewhere between $1.8 billion and $2 billion in revenue this year, I think, which is significantly down from what it's used to. I would think there have got to be people there kind of thinking, okay, what if we put like this Canadian winner in a position where they could draw a crowd for round three, or if they get there, round four. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but
yeah,
I got to think people are thinking
isn't
about
there something,
it.
Isn't there something going on with the arena there? I may be wrong about that. I thought they were doing something to the arena, but I'm, you know, in Buffalo. But I guess, Elliot, the question, the choice is going to be, you know, potentially, you know, again, and let's assume that they're going to be, they might have the option of crossing the border in the third round, which that does kind of sound like the league thinks that could be possible. So it would be playing in your empty home arena and sleeping in your own bed. Versus playing in a neutral site that's relatively close by with some fans and some revenue, but living in a hotel, right?
Like, yes.
I guess that's because there's no fantasy about fans in Canada in the third round, is there?
No, I don't think so. How can you, Steven? I
can't imagine.
Three of us are reasonably intelligent people.
Yeah.
Does anyone see that happening? I don't.
No. No, like I, you could probably make a case for it, you know, but I don't believe in real politics it's going to happen for sure. So, are there active, like they haven't talked about that kind of the neutral site idea for the third round. I know does that reflect confidence that they think they're going to be in Canada?
Well, I think that, you know, they've been planning that neutral site idea for some time now. It's kind of been on their radar. And I think one of the questions was, okay, do you put when the Canadian team gets through for round three, do we put them in a place that's near the border, or do they put them in a place like Chicago so they don't have to move, and you know that the travel is going to be easy, no matter who you play in the third and fourth round.
Yeah.
But so that was kind of always the original thought.
I think we just lost Elliot. We'll attempt to get Elliot back. That is an interesting, because I hadn't heard much discussion about that. And I think, I would be okay with it. I would certainly be okay with it.
With them playing in a neutral site?
Yeah.
Well, the Buffalo thing is intriguing, right? Because it's, especially if this is the Leafs, it is the Leafs in the third round, you know, a place they have not been for quite some time. And it would be tantalizingly close. Like, I think there are people who would, you know, even if the hotel lockup or the 14-day quarantine was still in effect, would say, what the heck? Let's go to Buffalo.
Oh.
Go to Buffalo, watch a couple games, come home and quarantine for 14.
Absolutely there would be. But I also think that's part of the equation when it comes to the Blue Jays in Buffalo as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's bring Elliot back. Elliot, thank you for your patience. You know, please continue your thoughts, because Mr. Brunt and myself are saying, like, for me personally, I like the idea of having them, of having the Canadian team play in a, you know, someplace in the northern states. And yeah, the idea of Toronto and Buffalo, I mean, if it's doable, I'm kind of okay with it. I mean, you know, the Jays are already down there. We've just seen the Raptors finish off the year. And I'll tell you, watching that crowd in Florida, you know, I don't know how I'd feel if there was one round semifinal round where there was folks in the stands and it was noisy, and another where there's nobody in the stands. I don't know how I'd feel about that.
Yeah, I think that now that the gates are kind of opening up, I can see us all kind of wondering about it. Like, this, like, they've obviously had, you know, the NHL obviously has hired some good lobbyists here, because I never thought they would get a chance to get the 14-day quarantine down to 7 before the deadline.
Right.
And they did. So that says to me that whoever they're dealing with has some juice, some pull. I think what the Canadian teams want is to play at home. And I think what the NHL has told the government is, we just need to know by the end of the first round, what do we have to do? Do we go to the States, or can the teams go back and forth across the border? And, you know, we'll see where it goes. But I'm pretty sure the Canadian teams want to play at home if they can, even if there's no crowds. And I know that one of the things they were talking about was they wanted to know that the Canadian team, wherever they played the third round, they could also play the fourth round. I don't think they want to have to relocate them between a conference championship and a Stanley Cup final if they get there.
No, that makes complete sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it does. Now, Elliot, there's, you know, almost literally nothing to choose in those, the first round games we've seen. Like, I'm not sure. There's never been a slate of games as close as that to start a playoff, has there? Like, we're seeing something extraordinary here.
Well, first of all, it was great to watch. It was entertaining, and you're right. There were a lot of great games. But you know what? Like, I was talking about this with someone the other day. Are there any upsets in this league anymore?
I don't know what it's a really good question. Like, what would an upset? What is an upset in this? You know, and any of those series we're talking about.
You don't think Minnesota Vegas would be an upset?
Minnesota,
no,
because
not
Minnesota
the way they played them this year.
Yeah, they handled them all the regular season, right? So, I'm not sure there is one.
I think the one upset is really Nashville. If Nashville beats Carolina, I think that's an upset.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, like, we'll see how Price is tonight. I think it's really interesting. I do think that the way Montreal lurched into the playoffs, I think you could make an argument that Montreal over Toronto was an upset, ducking. But you know, generally, like I picked Colorado to win the Stanley Cup. But, like, if they lost to St. Louis in the first round, would I be overly surprised? Not really. Like, there really aren't many upsets in this league anymore. I mean, the teams are close, and if you get any kind of goaltending, you've always got a chance. So, like this league is razor thin. It's, you know, if they've tried, you know, people rip them all the time and say, well, they try to create too much parity. Yes, I think that's true. But this weekend is the kind of time where you look at it and say, ah, I see kind of what the results could be.
What are you expecting from Sheldon Keefe as we get close to Thursday's game? He's made clear Jack Campbell will start. Probably not a surprise.
No.
You know, we've seen that veteran, that veteran-laden fourth line. I'm going to call it veteran-laden fourth line. What is the interesting thing to you, Elliot? What is the one decision that you are particularly interested in? That faces
I don't even
Sheldon
think
Keefe?
It's necessarily a game one decision, Jeff. I'm curious to see what his patience level is going to be. Like, let's say, for example, and I realize we're all talking hypotheticals here, but let's say, for example, they come out and they lose game one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is he patient? I think the same thing with the other bench, Ducharme. Like, they're already, it looks like, and he could just be playing mind games with us, but it looks like Caulfield isn't going to play. You know, if they lose game number one, you know, how patient are these two coaches going to be with their lineups? Both of them have legit NHL players who are not going to play on Thursday night. Is the loser of that game going to have that same lineup come out for game number two? That, to me, is going to be one of the most interesting things, because I think at this kind of year, the most important thing is to ride the wave. There's so much momentum and there's so much emotion going up and down that I think sometimes I think players take their cues from the coaches. Does our coach look panicked? Is our coach calm? And, you know, I think if you lose game one, how do you react to that? I think that's going to be interesting for both coaches. I think the other thing, too, the way that – just like who Keefe uses with who and who's on the power plays.
Mm-hmm.
I think these – he's got a lot of bodies, a lot of qualified players, and I think, you know, how they get put out there and how they get used – I think we're all going to be picking that apart.
Yeah. Well, you know, the chicken bleep answer is it depends how you lose, right? Like if Montreal loses and looks, you know, offensively challenged, Caulfield's going to play. Right?
Yeah.
I'll bet the house on that one, right? Like that. There are sometimes decisions that you're forced into.
Yes.
And they may still be a little panicky, right? But like if it's an obvious deficit and in theory you have the obvious solution to that deficit sitting up in the press box, it's a rare coach who can resist doing that.
Yes. You know, and like, for example, I think with Vegas, Minnesota, I really wonder, you know, I'm just looking at this from outside, but this is what I'm thinking they might be thinking is, was Fleury game one and Leonard game two, right?
Yeah.
And then Fleury is outstanding and gets beaten on a ridiculous goal in overtime. You know, I wonder, do you stick to the plan or do you say, yeah, Leonard's good, we promised him, we're going with it, or we're down 1-0 and Fleury was dynamite, we're sticking with him. I think you go with the plan, but I'll tell you, after the way Fleury played yesterday, I might have considered changing my mind.
Are you going to sub a guy out after, 65 minutes of shutout goaltending or whatever it was? Like, that's...
And a ridiculous fluke goal that beat him.
Yeah, so that would be a tough one. Although, again, Coach would know the dynamic between those two goaltenders better than we would, I guess.
Speaking of that series, Elliot, you guys talked about how the Minnesota played them well this year, but boy, Minnesota needed to win that game. Fluke by however many folks it took the puck to bounce off of, that needed to happen for the Wild, didn't it, in the playoffs?
Oh yeah. You know, you need that. You're on the road. You got to steal one on the road. And you play great. Now you have that. I think you believe going in because you played them so well in the regular season, but the playoffs can always be different. Now you really believe. Now you're sitting there and you're saying we can win. I think the team that's going to regret its game one loss the most is going to be Boston, because I think when you go down to Craig Anderson, when you're facing Craig Anderson, and this is what, his third game of the year or something like that, and you know, like, you have to win that game. You know, I'm sure the Bruins, and they let them off the hook. I think they had 21 missed shots, some great chances. I think the team that's regretting its game one the most is probably, to me, it's undoubtedly the Bruins. They were handed an opportunity there, and they fumbled it away.
Now, before we let you go, sir, I have to compliment you. It's been a big weekend for you, Elliot. They're prominently featured in the Globe and Mail, Canada's national newspaper. Like, what, 1,500 words or so, I would say, about the Elliot Friedman story, which was excellent. And also you appeared on the Sean McKenzie web series, the YouTube series.
A bigger deal?
Yeah, which is the bigger deal for you?
Well, I got to say, I thought the Globe story was too short, so I'll go with the Sean McKenzie's. No, you know, I got to tell you, I mean, I was, like, first of all, I'm incredibly appreciative of the story by Marty Klinkenberg. I thought it was, like, I don't always really like that kind of attention, and I almost thought it was kind of too much, but I really appreciated it. And I will tell you this, I don't want to go into this too much, but I was really struck by how some of my family reacted to it. Like, my family and I, we don't really talk about my career or anything like that. And some of my family let them know how the story made them feel. And it was pretty amazing, really. I'm really rooting for Sean McKenzie. You know, we're going into a digital age in our business, and I think we have to be good at those kinds of things. My buddies, I got to tell you, I had some of my friends, Stephen and Jeff, were just trashing me for some of the things I said in that thing. But you're kind of, like I could make out with myself or whatever I said right now.
You did say that,
like,
yes.
My buddies were just trashing me. But, like, the thing is, like, to me, that's acting, right? Like, we're trying to do something for a coworker here, and I think we have to be better and more successful at digital. So I'm really rooting for Sean. I hope I helped him get it launched.
I think you did, Mr. Friedman. It worked out very well. Thank you for this.
All right, guys. Have yourselves a great week.
Take care. That is Elliot Friedman of 31 Thoughts.
He's a good sport.
It's a good sport.
Yeah.
You're a good corporate soldier for mentioning that. Well done.
Well, yeah, no, it's good. Well, the Globe story was tremendous, you know, and I met Fried when he was working at the Gazette at Western. You know, there was a bunch of guys. The Feschuk brothers were there. Paul Wells was there. There were a whole bunch of people around the Gazette in those days. It was a really good crew. And so I went down and did a chat or something, and my old alma mater. So it was good. You know, and Elliot's earned everything he has achieved. He's a tremendous guy and a tremendous reporter.
Yeah, he really is. And the
And he's willing to be a goofball in the Sean McKenzie thing. So that's even more endearing.
Helps. Well, Elliot, there's like, we've seen Elliot in the summer when he used to come in and do shows here.
That's true.
He's not afraid to cut up.
Nope, he is not.
He's not afraid to cut up at all. The article was terrific. And of course it, you know, to me, the mark of Elliot will always be how he handled the swimming call in the Olympics and the reaction to it, which, you know, if you want to show journalism students or people in this industry a clear definition of what it means to be graceful and to just handle a quote-unquote situation, that is the way to do it.
Yep, you're here. Yeah, we all make mistakes. We don't all handle them as well as he did.
No, we can definitely say that. Pat Tabler is one of our Blue Jays voices on Sportsnet. No Blue Jays baseball tonight. They'll get back on the field tomorrow, first of three against the first-place Boston Red Sox. They're 9-2 after their against National League teams in interleague baseball after taking 2 of 3 from the Philadelphia Phillies this weekend. Yes, the Phillies aren't very good right now. They managed to, take 6 games, sweep the Atlanta Braves. The Braves aren't really good right now, but you know what? Doesn't matter. You put those wins in your back pocket right now, and those wins will all seem very nice when you get down to September. It's the Jays and Red Sox tomorrow. Pat Tabler joins us next. This is Writer's Block. You're the Toronto Blue Jays. You probably wish you were playing tonight instead of having the night off after that series win over the Atlanta Braves. Or maybe you don't, or over the Philadelphia Phillies. Or maybe you don't, because we're relatively certain that means that no one will get injured today.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, I wonder where they led. I mean, they might have want to direct the guys on off days, right? Just no skydiving. Right?
No skydiving. Yeah. No sharp objects. We had Ben Wagner on Baseball Central a little earlier today. He is suggesting that Ryan Barucki may be shut down for a length of time. In other words, that this may not be a day-to-day thing. And, of course, we know that Rowdy Tellez hurt his leg, hamstring, groin, some such thing.
Yes.
A move may be made, or will likely be made tomorrow.
Yeah.
When the Jays open that series against Boston.
No slight to Rowdy, but I think the bigger issue is anybody who throws the ball right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. They need, especially he throws the ball to their left hand. They could use a couple of those in the bullpen who are reliable.
Yes, yes. Nonetheless, as we mentioned, the Jays will get set to take on the Boston Red Sox in the first of 3 games tomorrow from Dunedin. They are winding up their time in Florida, soon to move to Buffalo, and then fingers crossed at some point maybe actually make it across the border to play honest-to-God regular season baseball at the Rogers Centre. Let's bring in Pat Tabler, one of our Blue Jays voices on Sportsnet. Pat, thank you so much for joining us. Look, we're almost at the quarter pole here. Some teams have played 41 games. Some have played 40. The Blue Jays will get there, I believe, on Thursday. If I had to ask you to give me 2 surprises on the positive side for the Blue Jays so far, 2 disappointments for the Blue Jays so far, what would be your 2 surprises and disappointments?
Wow. Well, first of all, I thought you'd say shuffle off to Buffalo. That's where I thought you would go with that. You know,
Say anything that trite. You know, he wants to be original.
No, I'm saving that. I'm saving that. That'll be trotted out at some point in the next week. Don't worry.
Or that. Yeah.
Next figure. If I know you guys, I figured that would be you, Jeff. Okay. Surprises to the good. How about the bullpen?
Yeah.
And the bullpen depth has been a nice little surprise for the team. You can't argue with everything that they have done down there. They basically have kept this together, I think, while they're starting pitching, which would be one of the disappointments, I guess you said. So we'll get to that in a second. But the relief pitching has been a very good surprise. And, gosh, this is funny. Seeing Vladdy in spring training and knowing he was going to be good, but based on what we saw last year, that's been a nice surprise, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Him losing weight and him getting off to the start. I mean, he looks like a legitimate number 4, number 3 hitter with power, with production, superstar, does things on the field that other people can't do. So I'm going to say Vladdy has been a nice surprise because we've been waiting for it for a couple of years. We were hoping to see this in spring training when he showed up and he looked fantastic. So that's a really nice surprise. So I'd go with those two. Now, mm-hmm. what were the other two?
The disappointments would be the starting pitching, do you think? Or
Starting pitching. There's holes in the starting pitching, I think, right now. They're just not giving them the innings that they need. I don't know if that is a takeoff of we only played 60 games last year. We don't know what we're going to get this year. It's only April. We don't want to push our guys too much as we get into the long season. But the starting pitching, I think, has been one problem that they've had. And let's see, maybe – gosh, it's not even a problem anymore. The defense was a problem early on, but I think they've straightened that out. Maybe disappointment. They haven't gotten much offensive production from their catchers mm-hmm. yet, but they're not in there to hit. They're in there to play defense, and they've done a heck of a job defensively. Buck was talking about it on the air the other day, that how many few pass balls and wild pitches, probably. I think he said it was the fewest pass balls and wild pitches in all of baseball. So that's a really, really good thing. But they're not in there for their offense. That would be really nice if their offense came around.
You know, Pat, I was watching, and maybe it's because watching the Phillies play some bad baseball yesterday. I think in the last month, maybe for sure, the Jays have played good baseball. You know, however you want to define that. You know, they've run the bases well. They have tightened mm-hmm. up defensively. When time comes to turn a double play, they turn the double play. Mm-hmm. Vladdy made an error yesterday, but they've made very few errors of late. Gurriel takes some weird routes in the outfield sometimes, but outfield defense hasn't, and they don't have Springer, but the outfield defense has been okay. I just think they seem smart and kind of alert right now, and I know it's hard to kind of put your finger on that quality with baseball, but that's kind of, and I think maybe that's helped compensate for some, especially some of the injuries, that they've had to run a lot of guys in and out of those lineups. But if you do the kind of stuff you have to do, don't make mistakes, don't make mental errors. It gets you some distance in that sport.
You know what I think it is? Everything that you just said, I think it's the youth of this team and the enthusiasm that they bring to the ballpark every day. What they're asked to do, not have a home field, to basically play in an A-ball stadium the first 2 months of the season, in a really hard stadium to play in defensively. If you saw the craziness that was happening on the field yesterday, mm-hmm. I think their youth and their enthusiasm to play the game of baseball has helped them get through all this. If you had a veteran team, a team of guys who've played 8-12 years in the big leagues, there'd be so much complaining and griping about everything that's going on and what they've had to go through, but you don't hear any of that from the Blue Jays. It's all positive. The young kids come to the ballpark every day wanting to get better and helping themselves. I think a lot of it has to do with the character of the older players that they have brought in, like a Marcus Semien. I know George Springer has been a very positive influence of these kids, and Tyler Chatwood and David Phelps have been very positive with these kids. But I think the overall youth of this team and the enthusiasm and the excitement and the love of playing the game of baseball, they love to play the game of baseball, and they really like each other and they like being around each other. I think that has really carried them here through the first 40 or so games of this season. That has helped them because the circumstances, again, that they're playing under are really difficult, playing in, not in their home ballpark and not a major league stadium, and the travel and all the other things, the accommodations and putting their family through what they're putting through, but they're soldiering on and they're making it through. And I take my hat off to them. I respect everything that the Blue Jays are going through right now.
And Pat, I definitely don't want to jinx them. So I'm going to say this with my fingers crossed, but Barker made a point as well about Vladdy. Maybe it's time to start looking at this kid and saying, you know what? You played every game last year while you were learning a new position. It was only 60 games, but only 9 other players, 10 other players in baseball can say that. You know what? It doesn't matter to me how good a player you are. If I can't see you out in the field there every day, you're not, to me, you're not going to be an elite player. And maybe we have to start kind of throwing some kudos to this kid. This kid's lost weight in season. He did that last year as well as the off season. And you know what, Pat, he's in the lineup every day. Like that's not bad for a 22-year-old kid who's learning a new position.
And he loves the game of baseball. He loves coming to the ballpark. He loves having fun. You've seen it. We've shown it on the TV, the things, the pranks, the fun that he has playing the game. And he's been on base so much. I like that they DH him every now and then to get him off his feet, because it seems like he's on base 2, 3, 4 times every single night. That can take its toll on you. And he plays the game hard, and he does everything the right way. And he just loves to play the game of baseball. We saw him. We were down by the batting cage the other day, not on the field, in the stands. And he came over just out of nowhere to come over and just say hi to us and talk to us and ask us how we're doing and stuff like this. And I kind of asked him facetiously, I was like, you don't have any fun playing this game, do you? And he just kind of laughed, because he just enjoys being around his teammates, playing the game of baseball, having fun, doing what he has to do to help the team win. And it's honest. It's not fake, right? It's real. It's who he is. And he's a joy to watch play this game.
Pat, have we seen enough of Charlie Montoyo now to say what a Charlie Montoyo team is, like what his trademark is, what his stamp is on a team?
I think for the time that we have seen him, I think what you can say about a Charlie Montoyo team is they play hard. They play the game right. I think all the players respect him because he shows respect to them. I think the communication level is high. So, I think that's fair, Stephen, to say that, you know, we have a team that Charlie has put his stamp on, that they play the game the right way. They come to play every day, and that's a big thing too, that they come to play and to compete every single day. You never see guys take at bats off or lose their concentration in the outfield or the infield or on defense. The relievers give their all. He does a really good job, I think, of using the bullpen, who's available and who's not, and getting the matchups that he needs. So yeah, I would say that he's had success in the minor leagues, and I think you're seeing it. He's had success now at the big league level.
We know that Rafael Dolis will likely be back tomorrow in time for the game. That's certainly indication. So it looks very much as if it will be he and Jordan Romano, probably Romano and him in some form in the ninth inning. What do you make of Jordan Romano and what we saw from him this weekend? I know that I there's still times I try to make this point with Barker, Pat, that when I watch Dolis pitch, there are games I know when he doesn't have it. And I think a lot of that is just because you could tell he doesn't have the feel for the splitter, and he's like a guy just sort of bobbing in the water, trying to grab any old life preserver at that time. But sometimes with Romano, I watch him and I find myself thinking, why did you throw that pitch in that count? You know, I look at that at bat with Segura. Why are you throwing a slider when you wiped out a guy with a 101 mile an hour fastball or a 100 mile an hour fastball the inning before? I don't know. Do you see it that way as well?
I do, and the only person who can ask that or answer that is the guy who threw it. We can second guess, and we can wonder, and you know, you got a 4-run lead. Why aren't you challenging him? But we're not on the mound. We don't know how you feel out there. If you feel you've got your slider, we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them can be like dominant. Or both of them can, like you said, bob in the water and have some shaky innings and all that kind of stuff. So you're banking on them being good, but there are times that, you know, they can, like Charlie says, you know, you can turn your hair gray as you're waiting and you're biting your fingernails.
Oh yeah.
But their stuff is so good that and that's the decision that the organization and the pitching staff and the coaches and the manager has to decide, hey, who's going to pitch the eighth and who's going to pitch the ninth when we're all healthy. And it looks like it's going to be those two or Tyler Chatwood or some kind of
AJ Cole, yeah.
All three of them at one time, depending on where they are in the lineup. So,
But it looked like Romano shook to the slider several of those pitches, yes. Right? That, you know, so is that,
yes.
When a pitcher does that, you know, I assume, you know, it, like, I know pitchers sometimes have a pitch they go back to kind of center themselves, right? Something that they're comfortable with to kind of straighten themselves out mechanically if they feel like something's off. Like, is that, you know, like, because I think Danny was putting down the one. You know, and getting, and he was, and Romano was shaking to the slider over and over again. Now he looked, you know, he'd thrown a lot of pitches the day before, you know, he didn't look right. Again, I thank God he doesn't appear to be hurt, but you know, is that something a pitcher will do to kind of get himself centered again on the mound?
They can. I've talked to pitchers about that, you know, like their release. If they release the fastball a certain way and said, man, I got to get on top of that. The only way I can get on top of that is try my slider. I don't know if that was the time to do it at the top of the order of the Phillies in a four-run game. You know, just, you know, hey, go work on it in the bullpen, right, yeah. if you feel you need that. But, you know, like I said, we're not out there. We don't know how they feel. It's their game. It's their stats. So it's their, you know, their choice. So you let them go that. Watching Jordan yesterday just didn't look like he was getting the ball out in front and finishing his pitches. And I think I said that on the air that he was letting it go. It's called casting, you know, like when you throw a line out into the water, you kind of cast it out there. That's what it looked like he was doing instead of getting his hand on top of the ball and finishing it out in front. That's just what it looked like to me. And, you know, they'll work on that and they'll figure that out and they'll go back and watch tape. But he must have felt good about that slider, 3-2, but he just missed with it.
Pat, it was really good of you to do this. Thanks so much.
Okay, guys. Have a good night.
You too.
And we've got a big one coming up with the Red Sox. They are red hot right now,
man.
It's going
to be fun.
Tomorrow. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Should be a lot of fun. Thanks, Pat. Take care.
Thanks, Pat.
All right, guys. Have a good day. See you.
Pat Tabler, Blue Jays analyst on Sportsnet. The Toronto Raptors are holding their postseason media availabilities. We had Nick Nurse earlier today. He will join Tim and friends just around the corner. And our friend Michael Grange has put an article up at sportsnet.ca that I'm sure will be the subject of some discussion on Tim and Friends. And we'll tell you about it when we come back. This is Writer's Block. All right, Tim and friends are just around the corner. Nick Nurse, head coach of the playoffless Toronto Raptors, will join Tim. I don't know if he's going to join Tim and friends or if he's technically a friend and will be there just with Tim, but he will be in the show. And Stephen Brunt, our friend Michael Grange, has put an article up at sportsnet.ca. And it certainly seems as if he has people whispering in his ear that Masai Ujiri and the Toronto Raptors are going to come to some sort of an agreement. And that this sort of the status, the situation as it exists now appears to be have part of a plan on the part of one side or both sides.
Yeah. Well, this Mike sourced it. Was it a source close to the MLSE board? So that would be as close, that is as deep in the inner sanctum of MLSE as you can get. So take this to the bank in terms of sourcing. And, you know, not guaranteeing 100%, was it 95%, right? But
right.
But it makes, you know, look, it makes great sense from the MLSE point of view that you would do whatever you could to keep him, to keep Masai around. And you probably wouldn't want to set up expectations that he's going to be around if you didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, you know, if anybody's fretting about Masai, and I know lots of Raptors fans are, that's a pretty reassuring story.
Yes, it is, and you're right. It would make no sense to not put this out there if it wasn't true.
Yeah.
If Masai isn't coming back, then you don't say anything.
That's correct.
And it just happens. By having this story out there now, essentially you were saying that somebody who is a well-placed source, and, you know, Michael doesn't use the word source at the drop of a hat. It's that somebody who is a well-placed source is suggesting that this thing is about 95% done. If it doesn't happen, then people are going to assume that it was MLSE that botched this. Mm-hmm. So there's really no point in having this story out there unless you're reasonably certain, unless you have a pretty good read in the situation. And I keep getting back to what our friend Doug Smith said. This doesn't mean than he necessarily has to sign for 5 years or 3 years. Certainly would not be the first organization to have its president operate in a handshake agreement. Wasn't that Beeston's big thing all the time with the Blue Jays?
Basically, you know. Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I'm here as long as they want me to.
And, yep, I think so. Look, Masai may well want to do other things in his life. I think we've always talked about that, right? Or there may be other challenges in other places in basketball or outside of basketball. But I think it makes incredible sense from the MLSE side to say to do whatever you can, because if they lost him now, even if Masai stood up and said, this is all me, it would cause a little crisis of confidence in the organization, right? A lot of that is rooted right in him, right? And in him personally. So you would, I could never understand the idea that MLSE was playing hard to get here at all.
No, I don't.
Doesn't make any sense.
What is MLSE? What are they going to? MLSE has never counted pennies when it's come to its front office.
Nope,
it just hasn't. You can criticize it for a lot of things, but it's never ever counted pennies. If anything, it's been guilty of spending too much money in the wrong place. So anyhow, there you go. Maybe we'll get a little more insight into that from Nick Nurse. He'll join Tim and friends next. Mr. Brunt and myself will be back tomorrow. Have a great night.